today is the day we are going to start the book of Esther. And I'm calling this series, God is Not Abandoned. And I hope that we'll take away some eternal truths from this different book, and that God has not abandoned, and He is often at work. And a little information first about the book of Esther. The true author of this book is unknown, but likely someone who had first-person experience in the palace and experience with Persian laws and customs. This is only one of two books bearing the name of a woman, so we conclude that Esther was very important to the Jewish community and has a significant role in God's plan and purpose. The location where this is taking place is in Persia. There was quite a few resident Jews living among the Persians. And the time frame that this book is written in or taking place in is most likely the latter half of 400 BC, around the 480s. It's kind of a ballpark time frame. And just to kind of give you a little, if you've read enough of the Old Testament, I'm going to try to explain when this is. So Judah was taken captive and exiled into Babylon. Most people are familiar with that. And then Persia took over Babylon, and during that time, the king of Persia allowed the Jews to return back to Israel and allowed them to begin rebuilding the temple, which a lot of us would probably go, yes, we understand that. But not all of the Jews returned to Israel. Some of them stayed in Persia or in Persian-held territories. And so that is when it is believed that this was taking place, is with the Jewish community that was still living in Persia. And so, this is taking place during the reign of King Xerxes. So the NIV translated Xerxes. Now, if you have a different translation, you're going to have a different name of this king. And the king is, in most Bible translations, translated as Ahasuerus. Both Xerxes and Ahasuerus, they're probably transliterated from the original Persian name. But guess what? I'm going to use Xerxes because not only do I use the NIV, it's easier to pronounce. But I realize it's probably a little more accurate with the other name. But there are some things that are lacking. Not all the details are here. We're not given everything. And so I think if God intended us to know everything about the background or everything that's going on, He would have included what He felt was important, and I think that's what we have. Now, I will tell you, this one particular element of this book of Esther stands out, and it is the fact that out of the entire book of Esther, there is not one mention of God. Do you know that? Not one mention of God anywhere in it. And here we have a book in the Bible with no mention of God. And now I'm going to preach through it. I really like an explanation that one commentator said, so I want to share with you. Even though God is not mentioned, we cannot deny God's presence and work through this entire book. From the beginning to the end, God's will is accomplished through people. It's accomplished even through the ones that don't honor God, but God still uses them to fulfill His will. So we may have some difficulty with the background details and a lack of mentioning in God. We still see God's care and work throughout this book. So to kind of begin with this first message, I'll be doing a little bit of summarizing. I'm not going to be reading the entire first chapter. But the opening scene of Esther is a great party. we see the result of an ungodly king indulging and showing off his wealth. King Xerxes is partying hard for 180 days. That's 6 months. So you think about some of our secular college campuses and the weekend parties that they throw, they've got nothing on King Xerxes. It is kind of sad. But in attendance at this party were princes, were leaders, nobles, very influential people from the provinces of this of King Xerxes' vast kingdom that spanned from India to Kush. I'll let you look on a map sometime if you want to know how big it was, but it was vast. What was he doing at this party time? Some say he was trying to convince all those influential people to go to war with Greece, which they were defeated, or Persia had a terrible defeat. Was that what he was doing there? The Bible doesn't tell us. What we do know is what's written in verse 4 of chapter 1, and I'll read that here. Esther 1:4. For a full 180 days he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. I can see him displaying his wealth by throwing this party. But to say that he was showing his splendor and glory of his majesty sounds like something that would be reserved for God alone. But this king was really full of himself. He really was. Having the wealth that he had, having the control, having the power, and this powerful kingdom and control of this large kingdom would probably cause someone to think of themselves like this, like they were a god. Kind of getting too much authority, too much control can corrupt someone. This is what happens, especially with someone who is ungodly. Moving on in verses 6 through 7, we see descriptions of the palace in Susa, where he was, and this is just one of three palaces in the Persian kingdom. I'm not going to read those verses, but you can get some descriptions that this place was significant. And to think this is only one of three really large palaces. Verse 8 shows that everyone was drinking heavily. I'll be starting with a little bit in verse 7. And the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. So we're kind of getting maybe a little visual, getting the point that this is 180 days of could possibly be binge drinking. There was no limit. The king lived as he wished, and so did the people at this party. Then there's a change in the story in verse 9. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. Now, I don't know. We're not told a whole lot about Queen Vashti, and we're told just this little part here. We know that the men were having a drinking party, and it's very likely that Vashti was having a similar one with the women. She was just as ungodly as the king, as far as we would know. Very much ungodly behavior all around. What often happens when people are under the influence? They make decisions with lasting consequences. There's nothing new. There's nothing new. In Esther, starting verse 10 through 11, I'm going to read on. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mamuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abatha, Zethar, and Carcass, whatever. To bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. I think it's just a nice way when they say that Xerxes was in high spirits, it's another way of saying he's drunk. And he has this idea of parading his wife in front of a bunch of other drunk men so that they can gaze upon her and be jealous of the king who has a beautiful wife. Just kind of explaining really what it is. We already know the king has a problem with pride, and you add alcohol in on that and it just amplifies the faults. The king has been impressing all these influential people with his wealth and extravagant things, and now he wants to impress them with the beauty of his wife. We read on verse 12. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. First of all, just so you get an idea of the Persian kingdom at this time, when the king gave a command, no one refuses the king. No one says no to the king. But Vashti did. Did she refuse because she didn't want to be paraded around? Did she refuse because she was intoxicated herself? Did she refuse because entering that space with this all-powerful drunk king would be not a safe place? We don't know. You know, I know some people want to paint this really nice picture of Queen Vashti as she's a pure queen and she was righteous, but there's a lot of reading into the text to get that's not there. Now, she may have been better than I've kind of painted her, but I'm just thinking you have parties on both ends. It's likely that she was probably at the same level as the king. But we don't know. But she did refuse to go to the king, and that brought shame on the king instead of impressing others. He felt embarrassed. So what did that lead? This drunk king is now angry. And what does any drunk, powerful king do in times like this? He listens to poor counsel. So let's read what this poor counsel looks like. In verse 15, according to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? So this is the king asking his advisors. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan, he's a character, he replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Memucan, suggesting that there is going to be a great uprising of wives who will disrespect and disobey their husbands because of the queen's actions. It's horrible advice. So, but the king, he accepts this advice and he removes Vashti from her royal position as queen and commands all women everywhere to respect their husbands, which really means wives needed to do what their husbands said. Verse 22, He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's language or people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household. And that is the time and circumstances surrounding what is going to be happening in this book. It's interesting that even Vashti was villainized by refusing the king's order. I highly doubt that the king, if he had not been intoxicated, would have still made that command at all. See, we see that he likely regretted what happened, and I think the king really did love Vashti. We see in verse 1 of chapter 2, later, when the anger of the King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Now, he doesn't say he regretted it, but just the way it's written, it's like he's remembering. He's, by commanding Vashti, it was a command that she was never, ever to come into his presence again. That she would no longer be treated as the queen, likely put back in a harem of other wives or concubines. I think after sobering up and coming to terms with his decree, I do think he regretted what he had done. But that's the consequences. The king now had to live with the consequences of his actions and those of his advisors. And he had to deal with the consequence of making a decree. See, once a decree is made, the king cannot take it back. Once he makes a decree, it cannot be changed, it cannot be repealed, it cannot be voided. It is there forever. It doesn't matter the circumstances, which we'll find out later why that's important too. So as I'm going through this, I've just kind of shared with you most of chapter 1, and we probably can take some teachable moments away from this, especially kind of what I've already done a little bit with intoxication and consequences. But the overall question that I really see that needs to be asked and answered, okay, so I've gone through that little bit, so what? So what? Who cares about this Persian king who's full of himself, gets drunk, and then feels insecure when his wife refuses to be paraded around in front of a bunch of drunk men? Who cares that the king then made an example out of the queen and has her removed from her position? What does this really matter? What does it matter to me, or what does it matter to you? And I think that's a reasonable question to ask. For some, this may just really be background information to the bigger points that are going to be coming up later on in this book. But I think there's still something here that we can take away. Even though all of this appears to be wicked and evil, even though that the king and the queen are ungodly people and the advisors are worthless, God is still at work through all of it. God is still working through this. You see, there are Jewish people that did not return to Israel, and some of them are living in a nation whose ruler is this king. Obviously, he has no honor or respect for the one true God. And the Jewish people that are living in this exile place, many of them not really knowing anything else. They were born there. They're going to die there in this country that's not their own. And in that time, could these people be wondering, does God still care about them? Is God only God when they live in Israel? Or is he still God of all the time, everywhere? And when you see this king partying hard for a half a year, they're probably seriously questioning his ability to direct this nation. We could probably get into politics here, but we'll save that for a different time. Though it might be difficult to see, God is still at work. And even though Persia seems way outside of honoring God, God is working through the actions of these ungodly to bring about a plan and a purpose. We know this because when we read through this story from beginning to end, we know that it's without a doubt God is at work in the beginning here. In chapter 1, the salvation of his people would not have happened if not for the events of this first chapter. Now, you and I want to be living for the Lord. And we look to serve the Lord, and we're promised some blessings, that he'll bless us when we serve him. But those who reject him and are actively disrespecting of him, they may think that they're doing anything they want. But are they really outside of his control? Are they outside of God's control? They're not. You see, we are all God's creation. For those that reject him, yes, there's consequences for it. But God is still at work, directing. I think one commentator says, it's kind of like oxygen. You might think that you can do okay without it, but as soon as you cease to have it, you're dead. You may think that you're independent of God or that you can run away from him and not have anything to do with God. But he's still there. Now we have the consequence, they have the consequences to deal with that. But no one can live independent of God. So as I was going through this, something came to mind, and I started to think back to when the Israelites went to Egypt. You see, Egypt initially was a place of refuge because of Joseph. You know, the whole story of Joseph. He was sold into slavery by his brothers. He ended up going through a whole bunch of things. But ultimately, he came to be very powerful. And it was because of Joseph that the Israelites were saved from that terrible famine. He cared for them and he brought them to Egypt. But then Egypt kind of forgot about all that Joseph had done, and the Israelites became slave of an evil Pharaoh. As the Israelites cried out to God, I'm sure they wondered, why was Pharaoh allowed to rule them? Where was God, and does he still care about them? Does he care that they're in misery? Then God gave some strong words in Exodus 9:16 concerning Pharaoh. And I wanted to read that this morning. Exodus 9:16. This is what God says, "But I have raised you, Pharaoh, I have raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth." God raised up this evil Pharaoh so that God could show his power. And because of what he was about to do to Pharaoh when this was in that time frame here of this verse, what God was about to do with Pharaoh, God's name would be proclaimed in all the earth. Wow. God raised up Pharaoh. Yet suffering took place to get there. When looking at King Xerxes and the circumstances with Vashti, that all took place so that God could bring up someone to effectively usher in God's salvation of his people for that time and that place. But we might sit back and think, why go through all that? How many suffered under Pharaoh before the Israelites were saved? How many might have to suffer under King Xerxes before their salvation. And look at today, the events of this world and the fallenness of this world, the fallenness of our own nation that was originally founded on Christian principles. What is God allowing today so that a bigger plan will come about in the future? Maybe the future is tomorrow. Maybe the future is long after you and I are passed away. We don't know. We might be asking the question, why would God allow this to take place? Why would God allow these things to happen in our nation or in our communities? And we don't have the answers. But our hope is that there's a bigger plan taking place. We might not understand why God allows some things, but then we're not God. I'd like to read Isaiah 55, 8 through 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Though in this book of Esther, we do get to see the plan unfold, we might not see things or the plan unfold in our here and now. All we can do is remain faithful in the moment. That's kind of important, so I want to repeat it. All we can do now is remain faithful in the moment. We have to trust that God is working everything according to His plan and purpose. We see things in the Bible, people who hardened their hearts toward God. Then they were still used by God, but their consequences will last for an eternity. Then there are those who serve the Lord with open hearts, and they were too used by God, but they also had eternal blessings to be had. And I want to believe that if I can have any part in saying yes to what God is doing now, that is where I want to be. I may not know the plan, but I will trust Him and say yes. Proverbs 3, 5 through 6 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, trust Him. In all your ways, your faith is in Him. See, life brings ups and downs. Life brings happy moments and hardships, and we simply live in a broken world, but God is active and at work in it. Trust in Him with your whole heart, and He will guide your path. Don't go your own way. Don't harden your heart toward Him. Don't think that you can do life without Him. He may still use your poor decisions if that's where you want to go. He may still use you. But you are going to reap the consequences for trying to go your own way. I'd like to close with a final verse, Romans 8, 28. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. In all things, God is going to do what He's going to do. Okay? God's going to do what He's going to do. There's nothing you or I, there's nothing that the people that hate God can do to stop what He's going to do. He is going to accomplish His purpose. Those who put their faith in Jesus Christ, we see that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him. Now I realize there are many people that love Jesus dearly and they've gone through some tragedies. They've gone through horrific things. Yet this is a promise that we can hold on to even when we don't understand. We have this promise that God is going to work for the good of those who love Him. Now, King Xerxes and Queen Vashti did not have that promise because they did not live to please God. We can see God is at work in all things, but we are promised that God works for the good of those who love Him. And I trust it. I know it's true. Again, there might be struggles to see. And we have to have faith and trust when those times where we are really struggling to see God's plan, that faith and trust has to fill those gaps. I'm going to love Him and look forward to the good things God has for me. And it might mostly be visible on the other side in our time, our eternal time with Jesus in His presence, but there's also good to be had here too. Will you trust Him even in the times that you're wondering, God, what are you doing? God, why are you allowing these things to happen? Will you trust Him in those times? And next week, we get to see a little more of this plan begin to unfold. But it starts with a young girl who really has no choice. And the circumstances are out of her control. But we see God working through her and using her.